From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. Today, we'll look at how Michigan is faring on what's known as the nation's report card.
We have lots of work to do and to continue to do to improve that rank, but it's good news for today.
And incumbent Karen Weaver and State Representative Sheldon Neely compete for Flint mayor.
Why wouldn't I run for mayor again? You know, we've done a lot. I've got a good record.
You have crime that's on the rise. You have educational needs that's in this community. You have blight in our community that we have to get under control.
We'll also look at how the Kalamazoo Promise is working to keep students from dropping out of college. And the history of Michigan's dog man.
He's described being 7 foot tall when he stands on his two legs. His eyes are yellow or they're blue. He's very agile. His howl sounds like a human scream.
Those stories today on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. Later on the program, the current Flint mayor, Karen Weaver, is being challenged for re-election by State Representative Sheldon Neely. We'll talk to both of those candidates about their desire to run the city. But first, national test scores show Michigan is inching in the right direction for reading and math comprehension. The state's national rankings edged in the right direction in fourth and eighth grade reading scores and in eighth grade math scores, though slipped slightly in ranking for fourth grade math scores. Here to help us better understand what these scores mean and why this test matters is Michael Rice, state school superintendent. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being on the program.
So the National Assessment of Educational Progress, better known as NAEP, why does this standardized test matter versus other standardized tests that kids take, such as the MSTEP statewide?
Well, it matters because it's really the only nationally comparable early literacy and early math tests that we have in the United States. So it's a big deal. They come out every 2 years. We look forward to seeing them, to being able to compare ourselves to other states. And of course, it's particularly important this year because we have great news to report.
Well, I want to be clear. Are we seeing improvement on test scores, or is this just about how Michigan is faring against other states?
Well, I think in terms of reading, it's really both, that our rank has improved to 32nd in the nation this year, from 35th in 2017, 41st in 2015. So we've improved 9 ranks in 2 testing cycles in 4th grade reading. In 8th grade reading, we're 28th in the nation 2019, up from 30th in 2017, 31st in 2015. We've had small scale score increases, 2015 to 17, 2017 to 19 in 4th grade reading. Relative to others, a 9 rank increase. And that's important, that when you see a deterioration across the country, it prompts certain questions about whether the test itself might not be harder, a possibility, whether there's something in what we're doing with early literacy across the country that could be deteriorating. One way or the other, 9 ranks in 2 testing cycles is a great news moment for Michigan. We have lots of work to do and to continue to do to improve that rank, but it's good news for today.
It is good news, especially relative to other states. I know it's not your job to worry about what's happening necessarily in those other states, so let's talk about what's happening with the state of education here in Michigan. What is the state doing that would have specifically led to these changes, maybe even if it's just holding firm with not losing traction?
Oh, I think a number of things that are happening to actually improve our early literacy efforts. The Michigan Association of Intermediate School Administrators, MAISA, its General Education Leadership Network / Early Literacy Task Force, has been hard at work. It created the Literacy Essentials with the help of not only practitioners in local school districts across the state, in ISDs, but also with the help of researchers at University of Michigan and Michigan State. So that's a major effort with respect to professional development. The Reading Now Network is similarly an important professional development effort around early literacy. And the Michigan Department of Education has been hard at work on literacy. Remember, we don't have the luxury of keeping a world constant. We have teachers that are retiring. We have the challenge of replacing 20 and 30 and 40-year veteran teachers and continuing to make movement on literacy at the same time. And that's particularly challenging in an era where there's a teacher shortage, not just statewide, but nationally, and where we have inadequate state funding for our public schools as well.
Well, I'm glad you brought up school funding because we hear a lot of outcry about the state of funding across all school systems here in the state, and many administrators and teachers alike very worried about what the funding models look like for them. Is there any way to tie funding to the outcome of test scores, or are those things completely unrelated in your mind?
They aren't unrelated. They are most assuredly related. Additional funding helps to increase teacher pay, which helps to stabilize the profession, helps with retention within the profession. That's critical, number one. Helps with class size, number two. Helps with professional development, number three. Helps with additional interventions, number four. You talk about the intervention of reading recovery, for one. Reading recovery is an intervention for lowest fifth or 20% of first graders. And it's a great intervention, but it's an expensive intervention. It's a one-on-one intervention that really works very, very hard with young people who are struggling to learn to read in first grade. It would be wonderful to be able to have all children who are struggling in reading in first grade have access to reading recovery, or if not reading recovery, then something with similarly small intervention sizes, one-on-ones, two-on-ones. So I think funding is absolutely critical to driving these results. Know that if you look at David Arson's MSU study from January of 2019, January of this year, Michigan ranked 50th of 50 in total inflation-adjusted revenue growth from 95 to 2015, 48th of 50 in per pupil inflation-adjusted revenue growth during that same 20-year period of time. Some people say, well, you know, why are you going back to 1995? But it courses through to 2015. I think that that's the point, that there are children in our public schools today that have been adversely affected by those inadequate dollars. Know that Michigan and West Virginia are the only two states that had negative real growth in revenue for education during that 20-year period of time. And we're catching up now, Laura, in some very substantial respects, catching up both financially and pedagogically.
Michael Rice is State School Superintendent. Superintendent Rice, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
We turn now to Brian Gutman with the Education Trust Midwest for his take on the results. Brian, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So first, what do you make of the news about the NAEP test results?
Well, we really have a mixed bag this year. We have some really promising signs, things like low-income students that are the fastest improving in the nation in eighth grade math. But overall, the results that we see are still pretty disappointing. We don't have major gains to talk about. And Michigan still has a long way to go to making sure that students are prepared and that we don't have the kind of equity gaps that are present today.
So my understanding is that Michigan necessarily isn't improving by leaps and bounds in test scores proper so much as other states are slipping. And so our ranking is increasing. How should we feel about that?
I don't know about you, but I'm really not satisfied with moving up in the rankings because others are moving down. What we really need to see are things like more equitable investments so that students are supported based on their need, and policies and practices that are really based in best practice so that our students in Michigan are moving up because they're learning more and they're doing better. That's really what we need to be seeing in Michigan, and we're not yet.
What is the practical application for test results like this? Are they directly or indirectly tied to any tangible changes such as funding or structural changes?
They aren't, but they should inform how we invest and what we invest in, as well as what policy changes we can make. So, for example, Michigan since 2003 has not seen increases in fourth grade reading and early literacy that entire time. We know this is a critical factor. We have the reading retention law in place this year in Michigan. We've invested about $120 million as a state to improving that metric. At the same time, Tennessee has improved their early reading metric by 7 points. So this kind of data should be informing our practice. What is a state like Tennessee doing that's showing strong results that's different from what we're doing?
So what is Tennessee doing?
Well, for one thing, they have a very focused approach on talent. This is very similar to what has been going on in Detroit over the last 2 years, and Detroit is also seeing some interesting increases. They're really focusing in on how do you attract and retain educators? How do you support them once they're there to continuously improve? What is that feedback loop looking like? And how are things like educator evaluations linked to data and driving professional development so that teachers get relevant, timely, high-quality professional development every single year and are really supported to support their students and continuously improve?
Brian, we have just a minute left, but I want to know if test scores like this are ever used as leverage either on the campaign trail or when it comes to crafting policy, or are they just sort of there for us, for you and I to get together once a year to talk about?
I certainly hope it's for more than only you and I getting together once a year to talk about, although I do enjoy that. But really, you know, we do see this on the campaign trail. People like to talk about rankings going up and sometimes rankings going down. What we really want to see is this used by policymakers and district leaders to better inform how we operate public education in Michigan.
Brian Gutman with Education Trust Midwest. Brian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll look at how the Kalamazoo Promise is working to stop students from dropping out of college before they get a degree.
Especially the first-generation students that do not have a lot of resources and are lacking in privilege, it makes it very difficult for someone to be able to complete the journey.
That's coming up in 10 minutes on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, filling in for Cynthia Canty. Well, it's Wednesday, so it's also time to take a look at a piece of Michigan history with the Michigan History Center. He was 7 feet tall. He had shining eyes and a terrifying howl. He looked like a man, but was more like a dog. He was the Dog Man of Michigan. On this day before All Hallows Eve, let's explore the legend of the Dog Man from the late 1800s with Rachel Clark from the Michigan History Center. Rachel, welcome.
Thank you.
So, what is the legend of the Dog Man?
The legend of the Dog Man. So, this is a part man, part dog that people have been encountering throughout Michigan and parts of Wisconsin for about the last 130 years. The reports vary, but he's described being 7 foot tall when he stands on his two legs. His eyes are yellow or they're blue. He's very agile. His howl sounds like a human scream. He is everything you would expect to find in a dog man in the woods of Michigan.
So what were some of the specific reports that people had of sightings?
Back in some of the original encounters are a lot of logging camps that see him or her. I guess we assume it's a man.
And it could be a dog woman.
Yes. It was wearing pants. So that's 1887 in Wexford County. So the early reports are usually of men working in the woods who encounter this beast during their time there. And then over the years, it's a lot of times people who are, again, alone, either on an isolated road or in the woods. Their encounters are very similar, though. They do talk about this beast coming out of the woods. It is very agile. It jumps in front of their car or in front of them. It scratches at their houses or their tents. So the encounters, as described, are very, very similar in that way.
And do people report being afraid or just sort of surprised and confused?
Afraid, very afraid. There have been reports, as any good story goes, that people have been scared to death by the sightings of the Dogman. There have been quite a few of those, especially earlier on. And then the more recent encounters are just people who are afraid and also very confused at what they think they're seeing.
So how long did this saga last?
It has been actually going on for a long time. As I said, it starts in 1887 in Wexford County by two lumberjacks. And then the reports are Dogman makes an appearance every 10 years on years that end with a 7. So starts in 1887.
That's so funny.
Recorded encounters. And then 97, 07, and so on, all the way up through. So that is how those encounters tend to go. I don't know where he's going for those other 10 years, but apparently a couple years ago, he made an appearance somewhere.
So we know, just based on human biology, that we didn't have a man who was living for 100, 150 years as a dog man. Were there any confirmed sightings or anything that we knew that sort of pinpointed who or what this might be?
There have been, especially in recent times, reports and actual descriptions of the encounters and quote-unquote proof of the encounter. There are photographs. I just heard a OnStar phone call from somebody. Apparently, it was totally fake, but reporting to OnStar that Dogman ran in front of his car and he flipped his car. But those are the types of evidence that people are putting forth. And then there is one film that came out called the Gable film.
Yes. What is the Gable film?
Yes. The Gable film, it looks like it's filmed on like nine millimeter film. And it looks like the 70s because of the vehicles. And there are people who look like they're on vacation and they're snowmobiling. And there's a young boy who has the camera when he's in his car and he's panning across the scenery in the car and he captures this thing in the woods that they're driving by. So the Gable film for a little bit was supposed to be the evidence of Dogman's existence in northern Michigan. And then it came out to be completely fake. The people who created it admitted that they faked it. It's a really good fake. They did it. They put a lot of effort into it.
It kind of reminded me in watching it of the Blair Witch Project movie.
Blair Witch.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah. Yep. Well, yes, like you said, it was a good fake. And there was a movie, I think, that was created around it mm-hmm. as well, this legend.
Yep. You always get stuff like that.
Talk about popular culture as it relates to Dogman.
Dogman appears in popular culture in the 80s. Steve Cook, who was a Traverse City disc jockey, wrote a song about the legend of Dogman. And so he sort of outlined this story in the song he put together. And then he played it on air. And this was, again, in 1987, a year ending in 7. And he is also purportedly behind that Gable film. So he just sort of did it as a thing to do. He put the song together. He put it out there. But then people were reporting that they actually were seeing things. And so that's the earliest sort of pop culture reference that we can find in terms of the Dogman. Then again, people, and even if you look online, people report what they think they see in the woods of Michigan as something they cannot identify. Therefore, maybe it was Dogman because it was a beast and it was very large.
Dogman is the thing that just houses all of the things we cannot explain.
Exactly.
So tell me how this crosses lines into Wisconsin.
There is a very similar beast, I guess, the Beast of Bray Road, which I think is a pretty cool name. Uh-huh. And those encounters in Wisconsin date to the 30s, and they're very similar. It's a dog-like man or a Sasquatch-like person. And this one is known for jumping over motorists to scare them and makes these very quick appearances. But again, it's very big. He's very elusive. He's very agile. Very similar to Michigan's Dogman.
So either he's well-traveled or we have a whole species that we're unaware of.
Yes.
So why do you think stories like this persist in the minds of Michiganders?
My opinion, part of it is that Michigan and Wisconsin, there are just these huge tracts of land that are woods and open. And, you know, there are all sorts of things that live in it. And when people are hunting or fishing or camping and they see something, they could see all sorts of things that they can't explain. And if you get enough people who claim to encounter something, then these myths and legends perpetuate. So I think that it's just people encounter things in the woods that they can't explain. And, you get people of similar thinking and they just sort of kind of go with one another. But, for a long time, there were stories of large cats in Michigan that were sort of dismissed. And now we've got cougar sightings.
Yes, that's
there's quite
true.
A few in the last few months. Well, so I'm not saying there's a dog man out there that's going to show up. However, who knows what's living in the forests of Michigan?
I do know somebody who swears she saw a black panther or something cat-like run in front of her in northern Michigan, but I'm going to tell her maybe it was Dogman.
Who knows? You only really can tell, apparently, if it stands up on its two legs.
All right, so it was probably a black panther. All right, Rachel Clark from the Michigan History Center, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
A cool summer morning in early June is when the legend began. At a nameless logging camp in Wexford County, where the Manistee River ran. 11 lumberjacks near the Garland Swamp found an animal they thought was a dog.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. The Kalamazoo Promise made national news in 2005 for covering college tuition for all of Kalamazoo's high school graduates, thanks to the philanthropic investment of an anonymous donor or donors. Many cities have sought to replicate the Kalamazoo Promise in some part, but the Kalamazoo's model is still the standard bearer. Yet, the Promise hasn't experienced quite the sweeping success one may think would be inherent with a free ride to college. And perhaps it's because of that faulty notion that anything in life is a free ride. Folks at the Kalamazoo Promise organization realized students are often confronted with major life circumstances that make tackling college extremely difficult. So they hired so-called reconnection specialists to find out what was stopping individuals from graduating and to get them reconnected. Here to talk about how that works is Angelita Aguilar, Director of Credential Completion at the Kalamazoo Promise. Angelita, welcome.
Thank you.
And Alexia Jones, a reconnection specialist at the Kalamazoo Promise. Alexia, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Angelita, I want to start with you. When did you realize that you needed to address students failing to complete their college degrees?
When I first came to Kalamazoo, I was really excited to work for a KPS school and supporting students that were going to be Promise recipients. In its idea, it is a brilliant idea. The execution, though, I don't think that the thought went into what other barriers are there when it comes to policies and procedures in regarding post-secondary. That was one of the things that was pretty obvious. And the other thing that we realized also was that it's not enough to say, we'll pay your tuition and fees, but if there is housing insecurity, if there are just life issues that come at students, especially the first generation students that do not have a lot of resources and are lacking in privilege, it makes it very difficult for someone to be able to complete the journey. Secondly, when the Kalamazoo Promise was announced, everyone was very excited. And also they were excited about the fact that at the time, college was, the four-year institutions. One of the things that we are doing is emphasizing that post-secondary achievement can mean many, many things. And that is one of the outreaches that we're doing, that if someone was in the wrong major or in the wrong institution, they have a chance to redo.
So what are the specific societal forces at play here that are precluding students from finishing?
Even though we cover tuition and fees, students still have to complete the FAFSA because that will help with the Pell Grant part. We have students who have family insecurity, so they don't have the parent to help them fill out the FAFSA. Without that FAFSA, they won't be able to get housing, room and board, books, materials, transportation, basic things that we would say, well, they can figure it out. Well, there are a lot of barriers.
The Upjohn Institute did some research around this and showed that more students of color rather than white students were facing some of the barriers. Talk a little bit about that side of it.
The Kalamazoo Promise has this great idea. I think one thing that wasn't put into consideration was that we inherently live in a society that still, white is privilege and people of color do not have the privileges that white folks do. And we just have to accept that. And we have to say it out loud to be able to then help and make sure that we remove the barriers. I don't see it as a student issue. I see it as an institutional issue. And that is one of the things that we are collaborating with Western Michigan University, with Kalamazoo Valley Community College, and trying to figure out avenues for our students to be able to complete certificates or degrees.
Alexia, I want to turn to you. Did you have that support system at home that is needed to get through some of the barriers that we were just discussing?
No, not really. I grew up in a single-parent household, so my mom and my four older siblings. I am the youngest of five, so I was the first one to actually complete high school and go on to college.
How did you do that? I had to figure out a lot of things on my own. Yeah, how did you do that?
I have a lot of support outside of my family. I like to call my family away from my actual family. So when I was in high school, actually, Angelita was my counselor and my dean. So she helped me a lot when she became my dean. My counselor and my communities and school worker at my high school helped me a lot. And teachers and just folks in the community who took interest in me and kept pushing me along. I had to seek out a lot of things on my own. So if I was ever struggling in the class or just needed some resources, just being able to put myself out there and go find them, talking to people, letting them know what I'm struggling with and allowing them to help me, which was a struggle of mine. I don't like asking for help, but I'm learning to do better. So literally just putting myself out there and really just having folks around in the community to wrap their hands around me and pushing me and motivating me and seeing the potential that I had and making sure that I was in the right places and spaces to reach it.
So now you're working with students that have dropped out or stopped going to school and hoping to get them back in. How do you help them if they maybe don't have an Angelita in their life, somebody on the outside who is a strong motivating force?
So one, really trying to tap into their individual strengths. A lot of times I feel like students don't give themselves enough credit and just knowing that they are capable of doing things. And obviously it's definitely difficult when you don't have the support or when you feel like you have to work 10 times harder than somebody else. But just trying to encourage the student and making sure they are self-motivated themselves and figuring out what exactly it is that they want to do and the things that they're good at, encouraging them in that force. And then just being there and helping them through the process. A lot of it is a process. Like if you never went to college, obviously you probably don't know what to do and how to navigate through the system. And even if you started at one point, but if you don't know how to navigate, chances are you're probably not going to make it through. So helping students navigate. I've been there. I've been to Western, got my degree. I had some classes at KVCC when I was in high school and even took some classes throughout my career at Western. So again, just being able to navigate. I know the system and I know if I don't know an answer, I know who to go to get an answer. So just again, being there to help students, motivate them and encourage them and letting them know that they are capable.
So Angelita, what does the process look like when Alexia is in contact with some of these students? How does the promise step in from a larger structural standpoint?
So one of the things that we do is we will seek out students, and we've become very good at finding people on social media. And so sometimes we start stalking students that way.
You mean finding people who are struggling or maybe have dropped out?
We have names, we have information, and sometimes even from Facebook posts, we'll go through. And if we see one of our students that comments about things not going well, it is very helpful to be able to then reach out to them after they make that comment and just be able to send them a message and say, hey, you know, I saw what you posted. What's going on? So we do spend time on social media. It is one of the things that we do. Text messages, emails, we do events in town. And word of mouth is starting to spread because we're starting to get more and more contact from community members that say, hey, you know, I think I lost the Kalamazoo Promise. And our answer is no. The only way that you can run out of the Kalamazoo Promise is 130 credits or completion of a bachelor's degree or 10 years. But other than that, we are really flexible. And Alexia has a checklist that she's developed where she's able to ask key questions as to if there's holds on their accounts, what stopped them the first time, what their future plans are. And as that, we work out a conversation. We set up a plan. If it means that we know that they need to meet us so that they can sign up for classes or meet with an advisor, either she will do it, more than likely she's the one handling those things now, or I'll do it too. Just get that support. Just be able to be there with them so that they can ask the right questions, because that is one thing that Alexia pointed out, is if you don't know what to ask or who to ask, then it's very intimidating. A lot of our first-generation students are under-networked, and that is something also that we're working with them on, is introducing them to people on campus, having them to know that they can go to a certain person if they have a question or a problem.
How successful would you say that these efforts have been so far?
I think they're successful. We are currently taking baseline numbers because I know data is useful. I find success in every single one of our students that we're able to walk in, that signs up for classes, that completes the FAFSA, opens a bank account. Because we are located downtown Kalamazoo, we have access to a lot of great services. We're able to then network our young people to navigate downtown Kalamazoo, which could be something that they hadn't done before. I can say personally, for every student that we've been able to contact and follow through with, I find it very successful.
Angelita Aguilar is Director of Credential Completion at the Kalamazoo Promise, and Alexia Jones is a Reconnection Specialist with the Kalamazoo Promise. Thanks to you both for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Still to come, we'll talk with incumbent Karen Weaver and State Representative Sheldon Neely about the race for Flint mayor. That's next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber-Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. Flint's Mayor Karen Weaver is being challenged for re-election this year. We'll talk to Mayor Weaver in just a few minutes about why she wants another term leading the city. But first, we turn now to State Representative Sheldon Neely, who wants to unseat Weaver. He is a former Flint City Councilman, and this was his second time running for mayor. Rep. Neely, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So why did you decide to run for mayor?
Well, I decided to run for mayor because I still live in the community. My family is here. And I didn't like the condition the community was in and the direction that it was going under this current administration. So I made a conscious decision to come back to my hometown to run for this particular office so we can have a level of recovery that we all can appreciate.
And what has Mayor Weaver done or not done as mayor that makes you want to challenge her reelection?
Well, I think she mismanaged a lot of different areas. You know, I think operational audits need to be taken, financial audits need to be taken. They don't have qualified individuals in position to service the residents of the city of Flint effectively. I think there's been a mass exodus of qualified individuals leaving the operations of City Hall, providing essential service for residents. And I think the money that's been allocated to our community has been, at the very least, a missed opportunity for us to be further along moving us through and out of this particular situation that we currently face.
Why does she need to be audited?
Well, I think there's a lot of dollars that's unaccounted for. And that's my opinion, based on what I've seen from the state side, more than $260 million from the state of Michigan allocated to recovery for residents of the city of Flint, another 100 or so million from the federal government, maybe another 100 million from the philanthropic community. So we got to look at really ways to be able to execute up on those opportunities by way of dollars to be able to make sure that residents have a better quality of life than they had prior to this water crisis hitting the city of Flint.
So you're saying that you've seen, as a representative, money being sent to the city of Flint that should have moved the city forward beyond where it is now, and that the money should be more apparent that was sent to the city?
Correct. I think it's a missed opportunity, to say the very least.
Okay.
For residents. And I think not only that, when I talk about operational audits, I think in an operational sense, I think people are not being placed in strategic positions as far as employees and those critical vital roles to move our community forward. I think there's just been a missed opportunity all the way around.
What would you specifically like to have seen done with money? I mean, where are the areas that you feel like the money could have been spent more wisely, or that operational decisions could have been made differently?
Well, just to take, for instance, you know, they called it a fast-track pipe replacement program. They had the colonel operating as the lead person on the pipe replacement. Then they moved to a company called AECON. And now they're with a company, I do not know the name of this particular company, but when you have a proven strategy and you have a tactical way that you're going to go about providing infrastructure replacement, you need to stay with one particular company if they're proven to be successful in operations that they're providing for the residents of the city of Flint.
So please tell me a little bit more about this contract that was awarded that you thought that should not have been awarded the way it was.
Which contract is that? I was referring to contracts that were awarded to those individuals, but then you have other smaller companies that were awarded contracts, and there's been a lot of discourse as it relates to those things, and been allegations made by some of those companies saying that it's been some funny going on about bidding and bid rigging. I think the current situation of that is a lawsuit still pending against the municipality for those particular allegations.
What more could the city have been doing in the wake of the water crisis to bring Flint forward?
Well, they could have been doing a lot more, in my opinion. You have to have a tactical plan. You have to have a strategic plan to move the community forward. We have aging infrastructure that was undergoing some operations to correct some of the lead pipe replacement, but also you have major hemorrhages of water throughout your system. And I think it could have been ways that you could have maximized the opportunities to be able to repair some of those things while undergoing the lead pipe replacement to save residents dollars and cents that they so vitally need in this community where the median income is only about $27,000. People are under the perception there was a water crisis only for quality of water, but there's a second part to this water crisis. There's the cost of water in this community, and at the same time, you have other pieces to this community that has to move forward. You have crime that's on the rise. You have educational needs that's in this community. You have blight in our community that we have to get under control. So you have to run all these things in tandem in order to improve the lives of residents of Flint and their families therein. And so you cannot ignore all these things that's going on while focusing on one particular area and not doing that at the best of the ability that I see that a municipality could have actually engaged it.
You were on city council in the lead up to emergency management that also would portend the water crisis coming forward. What is your responsibility in the economic crisis?
Well, many urban communities throughout the state of Michigan was affected with this emergency manager type of law. Many urban communities and low to moderate income communities. And so when we look at what was happening through that whole particular engagement of emergency managers throughout the state of Michigan, you have to look at the deconstruction of many urban communities throughout the state of Michigan, not only the city of Flint, but you have to look at the city of Detroit, Pontiac, Highland Park, and Flint as well. And so, that was another problem unto itself. And so when the revenue sharing started to be reduced for these communities that was already on the line, a financial interruption, the emergency managers came in under the cloak of saying that we're going to come in to help you. But many communities are not better off as a byproduct of emergency management. And so I was able to witness that firsthand when democracy was stripped from these communities of color.
Why should voters in Flint believe that as mayor you could be more effective than perhaps just one piece of a puzzle when you're already dealing with these great economic forces? Should they believe that with you as mayor that you could handle the economic viability and situation that the city is in?
Absolutely. I mean, my track record is proven as a city council person and as a state legislator. We do have a plan, and we do have a course of attack against these illnesses that we face inside of our community and their residential, recreation, economics, education, and safety. And we have a plan to counter some of the things that we are going through. And we have to inspire and install the sense of hope back into the body of our community. Right now, employee morale is very down. Community morale is down. There's a crisis in confidence as it relates to issues of government and community engagement, and we can restore and start to rebuild those things with me there. As far as a legislator, we perfected some laws around education that's been allowing people that graduate from high school with the Flint promise that they'll be able to go to college, also with legislation, and also moving forward our community with opportunities of literacy skills for young people by establishing a library inside of our community. And so we're coming back here for one reason, and one reason only, because I care so much about the community in which I live, where I'm raising my children and my family and my mother. And it's a commitment of love that I'm trying to come back to this community and save it from the ongoings that's happening as we witness it right now.
Lastly, I'm curious what you think is the most misunderstood aspect of Flint, a perception that you would like to change or correct.
Yeah, we're not a community of victims. We are much more a community of victors, and that we have to reestablish that mindset within our community and outside the borders of our community. People look at our community from outside and look at us as a dysfunctional community. We're much more than that. What I would like to correct is just that, you know, it's we're not victims. We're going to be one we refer to more of as victors. And my running for this office is not about vengeance. It's more about vision. And so we're coming back here to correct the course that we're currently undergoing.
Representative Sheldon Neely is a candidate for mayor in Flint. Rep. Neely, thanks so much for joining the program.
Well, thank you for having me. God bless.
Now to Mayor Karen Weaver, who took office in 2015, the year following the water crisis eruption in Flint. Mayor Weaver, welcome to Stateside. Why did you want to run for mayor again?
Why wouldn't I run for mayor again? You know, we've done a lot. I've got a good record. And we have made a lot of great things happen to me in my administration, and we still have more work to do. So why wouldn't I run for mayor again? You know, when you clean up a mess, you ought to be able to stay there and continue.
And why would you be the better choice over Representative Neely?
Well, some of it is what I just said. When we needed a voice, I was a voice. I was not scared to speak up. I stepped out on faith and did what I needed to do to make things happen for the city of Flint. You know, I declared an emergency. I did that. I restored home rule and got money for new pipes, brought economic development back to the city. Housing is happening in the city. And so I have a good record, and my record speaks for itself, I believe.
We spoke with Representative Neely, and he says that he believes there is some mismanagement, some financial and...
He knows better than that, and he knows that's not true, because anytime money comes to the city, it goes through city council. So where is a record of all of this money? He knows exactly where the money went, and he needs to, stop misleading the community.
He said that he would like to see an audit done of your administration. What do you make of that?
I don't make anything of it. You know, we were under emergency manager for the longest, so if we weren't handling the funds appropriately, they would never have left. So that doesn't threaten me, and it doesn't scare me. And he needs to talk to city council, because, like I said, anything that we do with money has to be approved by city council.
Well, he was a city council member when the city...
And he should know the process.
Right.
Because he was. And so for him to say that money comes to the city and there's no accounting, he knows that's not true. He sat on city council for 9 years. See, he knows that's not true. He knows how money comes through the city. And the other thing he needs to remember is when he sat on city council, they led us into receivership. So him handling money is quite scary.
That's what I wanted to ask you, is being on city council, is there more that he could have or should have done as a city council person to prevent the city from becoming beholden to an emergency manager?
Well, he could have spoken up and spoken out against it. You know, I came into office with no power, and I used my voice and got things, you know, going back in the right direction. And so when people say they had no power, it's not true, because your voice is your power. I remember when people said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to use my voice. The other thing he could have done was not told the people that the water from the Flint River was good for consumption, that we should switch to the Flint River. So he could have spoken out about the funds and, you know, talked about that more. And he could have spoken up and spoken out about the water. And he didn't either of those things.
Is there more that could have been done or should have been done in the wake of the water crisis since you've taken office, as far as ensuring people are getting clean sources of water?
What I would like to have seen done was, this was the previous administration, but when we were under Governor Snyder, one of the things that the residents were told was that the water pods would stay open until we completed the lead service line replacement. Our goal is to be done this year, and, you know, the water pods shut. So we have help centers that continue to be open, but that would have been nice. Another thing that we have been asking for, advocating for, fighting for, is for those residents whose plumbing and fixtures and appliances were damaged, for those to be replaced. You know, that would have been helpful. I'm also asking about is, you know, we have the lead registry. which because we had a public health crisis, and that's a way for us to track people that were exposed to the water and health outcomes. And we got funding for 5 years, and 1 year is already up. Well, one of the things we know is some of these things, whether they're physical health issues, mental health issues, may not manifest themselves within the next 4 years. It may take 7, 10, 12, 20 years. And so we need to have that in place, because people all around the country are not only looking to us to see how you handle a water crisis and you start advocating and speaking up about the issues and challenges around water safety, but also infrastructure and how we handle the public health crisis. And so I think that's something that needs to be taken into consideration as well.
Well, now that we are seeing some of these other large cities, Detroit among them, emerge with their own water problems, and we're seeing that this is much broader spectrum problem across the country and across the state, do you ever worry that Flint's stature in this fight for clean water and the right to water will be diminished?
No, actually, Flint is the one leading the way because people all over the country are calling us. They're asking us, how do you handle this? What do you do about this? Who should we be talking to? What should we be looking for? And so we've really become the voice and the poster child for so many other cities and communities all across the country. And one of the things we've always said to everybody is, don't let us go through a crisis and not learn from us and use us as your voice, because we know that there are issues all across this country with water quality standards, with aging infrastructure. I said the thing that I think the thing that makes Flint different is this was done at the hand of government, because, you know, we knew that we had a water problem for 18 months, and we were told that we didn't. But I am glad that people are paying attention to the importance of clean water and access to clean, affordable water. So Flint has played a leading role in that, and I think we're happy with that, because to go through this crisis and people not use us and not learn from us would be a tragedy as well.
Mayor Weaver, if you're reelected, what would you like to focus on?
Well, some of the things we've already started. You know, like I said, we're almost finished with the lead service line replacement, but we've got to finish that up, because even once that's done, I'm not going to sign off on the water until our technical advisory committee, which is made up of physicians, scientists, and public health professionals, say they want to see clean water in place and how long they want to get good test results before we sign off. So we need to continue that. Some of the other things that we have really focused on, in addition to what I've talked about as far as the needs that we still have, economic development. That's a huge thing for us right now, because one of the things you know is when you have a crisis, economic opportunities come as a result of that. And so we've really been playing a bad hand well, as I like to say, as far as making economic opportunities happen for the residents of this city. You know, we have economic development back at City Hall for the first time in 14 or 16 years, and we've really been focused on that. You know, when Lear came, it was the first time a factory was built in 30 years. We're still looking at other economic opportunities for the residents here, and it hasn't been just big businesses. We've really done a lot for small business and entrepreneurship. Housing, that's something else. Public safety. So, I mean, you know, we keep saying this is going to be a great comeback story, and we're in the process of that, and we are moving from crisis to recovery. So we're going down the road exactly the way we want to. People have said that recovery looks like jobs. It looks like opportunity. And that's what we're making happen here in the city of Flint. So it's an exciting time for us. It really is.
Karen Weaver is the mayor of Flint. Mayor Weaver, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Actor John Witherspoon died yesterday. The Detroit native was perhaps best known for his comedic role as the father in the movie Friday. Here's that character talking with his son, Craig.
Every time I come in the kitchen, you're in the kitchen, eating up all the food, all the chicken, all the pig feet. You ate my dinner, my mashed potatoes, that good old gravy I like, and the biscuits I can sop that gravy in. You ate all it up. You drink up all the milk, don't care what kind of milk it is. You don't care. 2%, 3% buttermilk, patent milk, polar cow in a patent milk can. I bet you eat that too. What's wrong with you? I'm hiding my grapes.
Witherspoon also played parts in House Party, Vampire in Brooklyn, and Boomerang. He had deep roots in Michigan, including a brother, William Witherspoon, also deceased, who wrote songs for Motown, including What Becomes of the Brokenhearted. John Witherspoon was 77. That's Stateside for today. I'm Laura Weber Davis. Thanks for listening. As I walk this land of growth.